Today's show is brought to you by us, the Choose Yourself Network. One of the most common questions covered on that podcast and by our guests is about self-publishing. James has written a lot on the topic and sold hundreds of thousands of books by leaving the traditional publishers behind. It takes a little guts to take on that risk, but James has narrowed all of the secrets of self-publishing your own bestseller into a single checklist. You can get it at www.jamesaltucher.com/bestseller. If you're thinking about writing or just want to publish your own ideas, it's a must read. Check it out today at jamesaltucher.com/bestsellers and download your free guide. That's jamesaltucher.com/bestseller, B-E-S-T-S-E-L-L-E-R. Thanks for listening. And now here's today's show.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So I have Oliver Berkman with me. Oliver, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oliver, I wanted you to come onto this pod. I've actually wanted you on for the past year or more. When did we first meet?
It's more than a year ago now. I think it must be year and a half, too. Yeah.
Yeah. It was right after you came out with the book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And you basically break down the whole self-help industry. And along the way, you met and interviewed and you read from the authors of many people, many of the same authors that I had read and met or interviewed or whoever. And I was really interested in some of your experiences.
I think I tried to get you to read my book and you emailed that you'd already read it, which is the most kind of perfect, it's good when that happens, when you think someone's going to be interested and they already were.
Well, you know, it's interesting because what I want to do is I want to kind of go over what self-help is, what do people expect from it, what works, what you think works in it. But first, in your subtitle is Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And so I kind of want to define those terms in your view or why you have that in the subtitle other than that's what the publisher told you to do.
No, that subtitle I brought to this party. I'd been thinking about this for a very long time. I've been writing this column in The Guardian, which, you know, the original idea, it's changed a bit, but the original idea was to try to sort the wheat from the chaff in the self-help industry.
Did you have and I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm always going to interrupt, but yeah. did you have an opinion beforehand about a blanket opinion about the entire category of self-help, even though we know now it's divided into lots of different little categories? Did you, prior to researching this book, have a blanket general opinion?
I had a blanket ambivalence. Let me explain that. I mean, I maybe this is a British thing. I don't know.
It's a British thing.
I had two opinions simultaneously. One is...
That's definitely a British thing.
Yeah, one is this stuff is just embarrassing, it's ridiculous, it's entertaining to laugh at it, never be seen dead reading it. And the other, at the same time, is like, well, actually, you know, like, if any of those promises were on the covers of these books were true, I kind of would do kind of want that. I kind of would like to be more productive and a bit happier and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that kind of, I think obviously mockery is always partly a defense mechanism. So I just wanted to sort of plunge into this idea and say, well, look, okay, clearly there is a huge amount of BS here. And yet I don't want to have to accept that wanting to be happier is BS or that, you know, the whole idea of improvement is somehow has to be thrown out. And what I really came down to, I can talk more about it, but you know, I think what really does not work in almost any circumstance is what I define as positive thinking, which is not optimism or being a happy soul or anything like that, but this conscious and explicit effort to control your emotions using your will, to bring about your goals by making really, really intense, clear, specific goals and just relentlessly driving through at them. That basically you can really try too hard to be happy or successful. Yeah.
Let me play devil's advocate in two ways. One way is you can say visualization or positive visualization is similar to positive thinking. So take a book like The Inner Game of Tennis or The Inner Game of Golf, where the authors suggest, before I serve the tennis ball, visualize in detail everything that is happening in the shot and, you know, assume the perfect serve and visualize it completely and then serve. So that's one kind of form of positive thinking. The other is, let's say I think to myself, oh, I want to write a novel. And then the first impulse that comes to me is, I can't write a novel. I'm raising a family. I have a full-time job. I need time, downtime. I can't do that. Isn't in both cases, or in that particular case, wouldn't it be better for me to think positively? Well, okay, maybe I can do this and I'm going to figure it out. I know I can do this, so I'm going to figure it out. And in the positive visualization case, isn't that proven to help, you know, in sports, for instance?
They're both really, really interesting, good points. I mean, I'll take the maybe the last one first. What I really tried to do in this book, after a couple of chapters at the beginning, sort of demolishing what I think doesn't work, is to offer a constructive alternative, you know, and it's all to do with getting more familiar with failure and unfriendly with uncertainty and being able to go forward without knowing exactly where you're going at every time. I think that the second case, you know, not feeling good about your ability to do something like write a novel, that's a great example where what really works in my experience, and I think the research backs me up, but anyway, from my experience, is not then trying to eradicate those negative thoughts, trying to sort of forcibly remove them from your mind and replace them with thoughts about what a sensational novelist you're going to be. It's much more about being able to just coexist with all those thoughts and act anyway. You know, it's much more about not being pushed around by thought. And when you do completely commit to this kind of very cliched philosophy of positive thinking, the only thing you can do with those negative thoughts is like fight them and treat them as an enemy and spend your whole time, you know, trying to condition your mental state in some perfect way. And it just like basically just never works. The what works is taking some action, taking some step, and then you find that the emotions tend to follow on. The visualization thing is really interesting because, of course, there is other research as well that suggests that certain kinds of positive visualization, like reduce your energy and your motivation to achieve your goals. I think a lot of it comes down to whether you're visualizing process, which I think has lots of good benefits, and I think that's what the Inner Game books sort of focus on, or whether you are visualizing, you know, total success, the end point, people cheering, the goal, everything's worked out for you. And I think in those cases, that's what the study seems to suggest doesn't work so well.
Right, because then you're setting yourself up for potential disappointment.
Well, and you're like, well, and because you're sort of endlessly focused on where you got to get to, it actually makes it less like one of these studies from Gabriel Oettingen and some colleagues at NYU. I don't know if you know her work. They got people dehydrated and then they had them visualize drinking a icy, refreshing glass of water, and the people who did that visualizing had a greater drop in energy levels than the others because it was as if they'd already convinced their brains that they'd achieved this goal on a mental level, so they didn't need to achieve it in the real world. My ultimate defense against all of this, you know, the answer I come back at to your devil's advocate questions is, you know, I really think what I'm mainly doing is trying to reset a balance here.
Again, though, I want to play devil's advocate. Let's take a more extreme example than the novel example. Let's say I'm a woman, I'm married, I have three kids, and my husband just cheated on me. And so I might think to myself, I should break up with him, or I should make some drastic change to my marriage and my living situation. Or, you know, and I could think positively, yes, if I do that, this will work out for me and this will create a better life for me if I make some big change in my life. Or I could think negatively, ugh, I can't do that. He provides half the paycheck. I have to put up with this and just be unhappy. Like, it seems like you're saying, well, okay, forget both of those kind of extremes and take action. But if someone's already thinking so negatively, I've seen this a lot. They can't really take action at that point. They're too focused on the can't.
Yeah. No, I see that. I see that. What I disagree with is the implication, I guess, that what you can do when you're mired that deep in negative emotions is make some other part of yourself, just make a choice to not think them anymore. And what actually seems far more fruitful in those situations, not to just give in to those emotions as in let them guide your behavior, but to find an accommodation to live with them in your mind, you know, to be able to not feel that there's something terribly wrong with you because you're feeling low or depressed, to be able to sort of treat them, you know, the Buddhist ideas, treating emotions as weather patterns, learning to be a little bit more non-attached toward them. And then from that position, absolutely take whatever actions you need to take to get yourself out of bad situations, but not as a result of having forced your brain using willpower to feel good. Obviously, in that situation, you could just as easily, if that was possible, you could just as easily force your brain to think your circumstances were wonderful and then everything will be fine again, you know, but it just, the human brain just doesn't work like that. It's too rebellious.
I see. So in this case of this, the woman in the situation I described, she could think, okay, this really bad thing happened. It doesn't seem like I can change my situation, but I'm going to not let these negative feelings overwhelm me. And I'm going to try to rationally figure out what my options are, as opposed to automatically thinking there is a way to change my circumstances, taking a more kind of rational view of it.
As opposed to beating yourself up for feeling bad, right? Because the implication of positive thinking, in the sense that I'm using this term, is always that negative thoughts should be banished, that there is something wrong if there are negative thoughts around, and
right.
that the focus should be on replacing those negative thoughts and feelings with positive ones. And yeah, I just think there's just so many arguments against that.
So to some extent, just by doing that, you're taking energy away from your brain that could be used towards solving your problem.
Firstly, there's that. And then secondly, it just doesn't work, right? I mean, it's that don't think about a polar bear. If you really focus on the thoughts that you have and you sort of declare war on them and decide that you're going to stomp them out and replace them with better thoughts, it doesn't work. They get bigger and more salient, and things get worse. And yet, you know, and so all the sort of Eastern spiritual traditions and a whole lot of modern therapy is a lot more about saying, can you find a way to coexist with these thoughts and emotions? Not with bad situations, which you may well need to change, but the first step there is not to beat yourself up for the fact that you have the full range of human emotions instead of only like one half of the
right. There's a saying, when something bad happens to you, that's like the first arrow and it could wound you. But then when you beat yourself up about it, that's the second arrow and that could kill you.
Yes, exactly. And look, there's something else about happiness for people who can't stand positive thinking, which springs to my mind. I mean, I think this philosophy about how to relate to negative emotions and situations is kind of a pretty universally good one. But I also think there's a big sector of the population to which I definitely belong, who are just like, we're not like super smiley people who bounce around the world out of bed in the morning feeling like life is absolutely fantastic. We have a sort of, you know, appreciation for gallows humor, and we see the benefits of pessimism, and sometimes we like sort of, you know, dwelling on the negative stuff a bit. And I don't want those people to think that, like, therefore you have to give up on happiness and just be sort of resigned to your life being bad or something. I feel like there's totally a kind of happiness that is compatible with, and success, you know, worldly success that is compatible with that kind of outlook. And those are kind of my people on some level, I guess.
Well, you kind of bring up almost an evolutionary point of view. If our ancestors were happy and positive 100% of the time, then they would have died. We wouldn't have been born.
Totally. And if when you felt fear, you could use positive thinking to shut off the fear, like, you'd die very quickly.
Right. The lion would eat you.
Yeah,
like,
right.
you should actually be really negative then and run.
Of course, evolution, as is often said, doesn't have any particular interest in us being happy. So,
well, that's right too, because you answered the question of what's positive thinking. But my first question for you is, what is happiness in your mind?
Well. I mean, when I started writing this book, I thought, look, if I'm gonna suggest that there's a different route to happiness, I better know what I mean by happiness as an endpoint. And I spent a good few weeks in libraries trying to answer this question. But then I figured out that, you know, I guess philosophers hadn't solved it for millennia.
Don't you think that's a weird thing that you had to go to a library to find out what happiness was?
Well, I failed, so the useful experience was that it wasn't there.
Like, why can't you just look at your, I don't know how old you are, but your 30 or 40 years of life experience and isolate when you were happy and say, okay, I was happy then and I was unhappy here, so this must be what happiness is.
I mean, I think what I concluded, it was useful to go to the library in order to fail the library. I mean, I don't know what happiness is. I think that this idea about being more welcoming toward negative feelings and emotions, I think that is valid whether your view of happiness is just, you know, material wealth or it's becoming a Zen monk on the spiritual path. You know, whatever it is, you can try too hard and sabotage things in that way. I mean,
so you just gave three definitions, right? So you gave one that was happiness is the ability to deal with negative emotions. Then you gave happiness is goal oriented, like I got $1 million, so now I should be happy. And then the third, I just totally forgot. But
spiritual path.
Yeah. So the happiness is somehow presence and calm in the moment.
Yeah, and I don't have an answer to this. I, you know, it's very nice to say, and I hope that I've come to understand that a lot of it, that spiritual definition is real. But I haven't detached from wanting goal accomplishment and enough money and things like that. So it's
there's also a fourth definition, which is again the more evolutionary one, where happiness is simply when dopamine, serotonin, or oxytocin is kind of shooting through your brain.
And there, I think, get into an interesting thing, don't you? Because I do think I'm fairly confident in saying that happiness is not a constant state of excitement or
right.
a constant state of deep contentment, which I guess are both of those are the ones that these, you know, the dopamine type explanations are. And that actually something, maybe it's not happiness, maybe it's authenticity or growth or living a deep life or something, but some of that absolutely has to do with being present through really crap times as well. I came across a quote attributed to Rilke, the poet, the purpose of life is to be defeated by greater and greater things, which I don't know whether the attribution is correct, but that seems there's something very powerful there. You know, it's about the capacity to experience more and not to have to shut down in the face of so many things.
Let me ask you about that quote, because part of your life, you know, as a columnist at The Guardian, you've interviewed many, many celebrities. And often a celebrity is someone who kind of reached their high point. So now they're a celebrity, and then they kind of coast out the rest of their lives on that celebrity. So they kind of are not really following that quote. Like they're not kind of experiencing, let's say, more and more difficult problems in some sense.
Right.
As far as we know, maybe they are. I don't know. What's your experience? I read you had a great interview with Jerry Seinfeld, for instance, who's obviously, you know, a great comedian. But has, you can argue, has reached his prime with his TV show.
Well, he has a really, I'll come to him in a second because he's really interesting on this stuff. I think in general, yeah, you see this pattern, right? Where why do people go off the rails with drug addictions or sort of material, you know, just going insane with their material acquisitions? It's, you're sort of at the end of the road of the thing that you've been focusing on. Then you get really interesting cases. I have a lot of criticisms of Oprah Winfrey and some of the people to whom she's given her backing, but not to others. And I think a really interesting case of somebody who sort of did that material success thing and then actually took a really interesting step into, well, what next? How do you grow next? How do you find the next big thing to be defeated by? You know, I think that you do occasionally get these super celebrities who do seem to be on real spiritual paths.
Like who?
Like Oprah, I think, is a really interesting example. She, like some of the guests, as I say, some of the guests that she ended up having on her show were promoting all sorts of terrible pseudoscience and shouldn't be there. But you know, Eckhart Tolle came to the world through Oprah Winfrey, and he's basically a pretty good thing, I think, for our understanding of human happiness. Jerry Seinfeld is big into transcendental meditation. The thing that really stayed with me from that interview was the way he thinks about his work as if he's an athlete. So he says, you know, I'm not an artist. I'm not sort of trying to pull off some work of genius. I'm an athlete and I have to keep myself in shape by showing up at little comedy clubs in New Jersey randomly, like he still does to this day. And, you know, testing myself and pushing and trying to keep this talent in shape. And, you know, there's definitely an argument that he hasn't done anything to match the TV show since, but that's kind of a way, isn't it, of sort of making sure that you keep finding your edge.
I guess also maybe we view it as a negative that he hasn't exceeded that his prime, but maybe he views that as a problem to get over, and that's actually the problem he's, you know, trying to have success over.
Right, right. I mean, you know, why? Who says he should do anything more sort of popular in a mass market way than that? I mean, yeah, I think that's a really interesting.
Right, like maybe his metric now is how do I get over that feeling that every day that goes by, people will remember me less.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And the trick may well not be to find something that people remember you for again. It might well be, as you say, to, like, you know, become a person who's kind of fine with that.
Yeah. Interesting. And I like how he just goes to random comedy clubs in New Jersey. Did you go with him to any of them?
I didn't, but I've heard various stories, and there was a big piece in the New York Times magazine about this that did go into those clubs. Yeah. So you're just there at some club having a drink and watching wannabe comedians. And then Jerry Seinfeld just comes on stage and tries out a bit of material. Kind of amazing.
It is interesting. Did you see the documentary he made, Comedian?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And I guess Orny Adams was kind of the guy that he was often following around. And they would perform back and forth. And Orny somehow never kind of got over the top. And whereas for Jerry Seinfeld, it was so easy to just get on stage and perform.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, it's interesting. Like, I started reading, this is my own confession, I started reading self-help probably when I was around 12 or 13 years old. But I was reading, like, really bad self-help because I was only 12. So I was reading things like, okay, how to have psychic powers or how to astral project, because I literally, my only goal was I wanted to see other girls naked. So I figured I could astral project and, you know, fly around the world and do whatever I wanted.
It's good to have an ambition.
Yes, that was my goal. That was my positive thinking goal. But that did lead to kind of books about, it kind of automatically leads to books about meditation, books about Eastern philosophy. I mean, they were all sort of, you know, those pop psychic books are really just kind of extra watered down versions of Eastern philosophy. And so it led me to the kind of whole spectrum of self-help from, you know, those books to, you know, very, you know, what's considered Eastern philosophy books. And the whole range in between. So what kind of self-help did you read along the path of researching for this book?
I mean, if I'm honest, I started off in a position where I was already pretty skeptical, bordering on cynical about, you know, the real classics, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and Power of Positive Thinking and all. They're fascinating historical documents, but I was never sort of particularly impressed by them as life advice. Then I got sort of kicked back into the Stoics and, you know, self-help before self-help, which I know you know about, it's just extraordinary to see that thousands of years ago people were grappling with exactly the same questions and sometimes coming up with the same conclusions. I think a lot of the most powerful stuff for me has been stuff that is on some level influenced by Buddhism and Taoism and sort of Eastern approaches, not always explicitly, you know, that those kinds of ways of relating to bad times and ways to action and procrastination and things like that are really powerful in my experience.
What's your definition of Stoicism? Because I mean, I think it's not that there's a full range of definitions of this, but I'm just curious. Everyone has something a little different to say.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There's obviously a sort of small s definition that is associated with the people kept bringing up, because Brits are supposed to be stoic in this sense, which is, you know, the stiff upper lip and you just get on with life and power through, even though you're hurting desperately inside, which is not a model for anybody's psychological health, really. And to be absolutely honest, in writing my book, I really plumbed for the bits that I wanted to focus on, which are to do with, you know, the power of negative visualization, the incredible freedom and preparedness that you can get from really thinking carefully about how badly some plan the way it sort of liberates you to move forward and try it out, because you've already been there in your mind, you know, okay, I'm not going to die at the end of this.
You're saying there's kind of a power of negative thinking where I'm about to enter in a situation, or let's say I'm thinking of quitting my job and starting a business, outline all the worst case scenarios, realize that you can handle the worst case scenario. And in a sense, that's kind of this stoic way of self-help.
Yeah, it's only one part of stoicism, and we can talk about the others. But I mean, what I just love about this is, you know, and this is again a divergence from positive thinking. We the urge to reassure ourselves or our children or friends, you know, when something is not working out or when something is uncertain in the future, the urge to say, like, it's all going to be okay, you can do this, everything will be fine. It's very understandable, but it creates this. It's got this flip side, right? Which is it reinforces that idea that it would be really terrible if things didn't turn out fine. And one of the sort of really great insights of Stoicism, I'm sort of getting it partly through Albert Ellis, the great psychotherapist who died a few years back now, but who I did speak to just shortly before he died. He'd say it's far better to realize that things could go completely wrong and it would be okay, rather than to convince yourself that they are definitely going to go right. Because once you've got past that, once you're like, okay, yeah, this might all be total disaster, but that's okay with me, the burden is lifted. You no longer have to endlessly replenish this optimism tank and say like, oh, no, I'm really going to manage this. You can just go forward and try it. And it's just a weight off your shoulders. And I think that is, you know, I think that's quite a stoic idea. They had all sorts of quite weird beliefs as well, but you know.
So. Let's go through that exercise for a second. So we talked earlier, you're working on a new book proposal. I'm working on a new book as well. Let's say you work on this new book proposal and you put a lot of time and effort into it and nobody bites and nobody says this is a book worthy of us publishing. How would you react to that?
Well, I'm sure I'd be really upset and annoyed. I mean, I just in case anyone thinks I've sort of got this sort of stuff all worked out. I mean, this is a slightly different question because I was talking before about the future, looking at the potential for failure in the future. And this would be an example of present moment experience of failure. I think that, you know, there's a sort of instinctive reaction in that context to say, this must be rubbish. I'm not going to keep trying other publishers. I'm not going to explore self-publishing. I'm not going to go back and make some revisions because it's just like I've just been defeated by circumstances. And I think in that circumstance, if you're the kind of person who says, this has got to work out, like I've got to sell this for a lot of money to a really big publisher, that's going to paralyze you when it comes to exploring other paths or thinking about self-publishing or thinking about making changes. You know, you're going to be like, it's going to be so critical that you succeed that you are going to be frozen in place. If you are the kind of person who can say instead, you know, this is important to me, but it's not my full identity. You know, it's a thing that would be nice to make happen. Then I feel like you've just got this much more energy than flowing into trying to make it an actual success. But, yeah.
It seems like an extreme example of this is the story of Apollo 13, you know, where they're going to the moon and obviously their identity is going to be wrapped around to the fact that at least for two of them, they're going to land and walk on the moon. But then something goes wrong, and not only is their lifelong dream totally crushed, but now they have to figure out how to live. And it's unclear that they're going to live. And they have to really focus on the present moment in order to live.
Yes, yes. The crises clarify in a really weirdly helpful way. I guess I don't see exactly how it connected to the Stoic point.
Well, the fact that the worst case scenario not only happened in terms of their goals, but it could even happen in terms of their lives. And so they had to quickly put aside the fact they couldn't sit around thinking, oh gosh, we're not going to walk on the moon. They had to really start exploring all of the alternatives to living.
Yeah.
And not just one alternative. They had to really figure it out. They had to solve a puzzle.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And there just isn't time. I mean, it's a very extreme example. So I can really get my mind around what it would be like to be in that context. But, you know, there's so many testimonials of people facing life or death situations for whom things that are not important fall away. And you are simply looking at the practical, rational routes to the things you need to the thing you need to try to achieve instead of trying to sort of feel good about the chances. Yeah, I guess that's an important distinction there.
So, but I'm going to take it to, like, this morning I wake up and maybe my first thought might be, oh gosh, you know, another day. Or maybe I was afraid, what if I don't have anything to write about? Or maybe I was thinking about some negative situation I had to deal with. Sometimes then, I'm gonna get back to the power of positive thinking. Sometimes it helps to have, not necessarily an affirmation, but just a way to kind of boost yourself up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not gonna, like, tell anyone who manages to use a kind of positive slogan and it works for them to say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should definitely be thinking negative things. I think it's certainly very limited. I think the sort of boost that those affirmations can provide, it doesn't go very deep. I think people with kind of low self-esteem, already thinking pretty bad things about themselves, there's definitely some evidence that can make things worse. But, you know, I have similar things for myself. It's just that they tend to be, they tend to sound like they're really gloomy on some level. You know, they are to do with how emotions can't, you're not going to change your emotions through your will. But action is the way to change them. And then I'll get out of bed because action makes you feel good.
So you're waking up and you're thinking these negative things. What would you tell yourself to get yourself out of bed?
I mean, I don't always follow my own advice. I think if I was, what I was doing, I would attempt to feel these emotions as fully as I could. I would attempt to see that they weren't me, that they didn't define me. And I would be telling myself that, well, the slogan that is coming to mind now comes from Shoma Morita, who's a Japanese psychotherapist who was very much into this perspective. And the quote, I don't have exactly to hand, but it's basically like, give up on yourself. Just be the best sort of, you know, flawed person who thinks you're, I mean, actually, I'm going to look it up now because it's so good, but he's basically saying, you know,
I love the idea of this.
Let me get it now because it's sort of one of my watchwords. And it's that, it's all to do with that. Here it is. He says, give up on yourself. Begin taking action now while being neurotic or imperfect or a procrastinator or unhealthy or lazy or any other label by which you inaccurately describe yourself. Go ahead and be the best imperfect person you can be and get started on those things you want to accomplish before you die.
Oh my God, I think I'm going to steal that in my next blog post, maybe.
You are super welcome. As I say, it's not me, Shoma Morita, but...
One's going to know who that is. It'll be no problem to steal
Give
that.
Give up on yourself. Stop trying to win this war of emotions. And, you know, the battle is won by putting one foot in front of the other, I think, yeah.
Let's take a look at all this, though, like, author by author. So the best self-help authors of the past century, like, take Napoleon Hill, for instance, Think and Grow Rich. What would you say about that book?
These are historical documents, right? So there are times in the culture when some of these things can have a useful purpose and can sort of make people realize that the sort of stifling norms of their community or the prevailing economic mood of the times is something that they can resist, you know, and give you a strengthen your spine a little bit. Basically, for me here now, and I think for lots of people here now in 2015, that those kinds of classic books are pretty much recipes for frustration. They play straight into this idea that you're gonna focus your effort and your energies on controlling how you think and how you feel. They set you up for feeling worse when it doesn't work, because then it makes it feel like it's, you know, you can't even do the positive thinking right, so you're even more of a failure. And so I don't think personally they're much use. I think that sort of tolerance for ambiguity, for books like, if you want a classic, I mean, I'll go in the order you give me them, but Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, that is a great book.
I don't know that one. Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway?
By Susan Jeffers.
Okay.
Which is a sort of classic, slightly cliched, slightly hokey, you know. It's one that cynical people like me maybe like to laugh about, but the message there is fantastic, right? That is not make yourself fearless. That is feel the fear and do it anyway.
It sounds similar to the Morita therapy you were talking about.
Right. And she wrote another book called Embracing Uncertainty, which makes the brilliant point that, you know, we spend so much of our lives sort of subconsciously trying to make things feel certain. And if you actually were given a list of every single thing that was going to happen for the rest of your life until you died, Even if they were all good things, that would be absolutely terrible. Like, you know, all the life, all the juice would have gone out of life if you had that. So actually, you might tell yourself you don't like uncertainty, but you would hate absolute certainty a lot more. So that's a book I'm very fond of. But sorry, I don't know if you wanted to go through specific.
No. Throw some other writers and authors, good and bad. Like, and there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the good is like what you just mentioned with Susan Jeffries is her name?
Jeffers.
J-F-F-E-R-S. Yeah. And so the bad might be Napoleon Hill, The Thing and Grow Rich, but I say bad only in the sense that he probably was sincere when he wrote it, and it was probably good for his times, which were around, you know, after the Depression and so on.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Then there's the ugly, which is self-help that is insincere but out there to make money.
Right, and I'm trying to think if I can even think of anybody who I honestly think is insincere, because I think an awful lot of people who I don't have a lot of time for are probably very sincere. There's a kind of genre, I suppose, of celebrity self-help book where you just think this person has wealth and fame for all sorts of reasons. Maybe they're really good at acting or sports. Maybe it's just luck. Maybe they got a whole lot of lucky breaks in life. But whatever it isn't necessarily something that they know how to turn into lessons that are applicable to anyone else. There's that old Norm Macdonald joke about a real book about a sort of 9-step plan for success, I think was the subtitle, but that Oprah Winfrey's boyfriend, Stedman Graham, published. The Norm Macdonald line is that if step one is become Oprah Winfrey's boyfriend, then the other 8 steps are probably just hang around. You know, there are people who you just think that there's no reason to believe that you would have achieved.
But you know what, though? He might be sincere. So it still might be... Yeah, and his book might be good or bad, we don't know, but he might be still sincere about it. Whereas, what do you think about things like, and we won't have to name any names, but like, let's say Law of Attraction sort of books?
I mean, the sincerity question is fascinating there. I'm a long time on the record critic of the Secret, so I don't mind naming names, but it's really hard to tell with some of that stuff. I think a place that it crosses over for me and really leaves a very bad taste is some of the people involved in that world who have turned them into sort of pretty unethical kinds of models for marketing and making money out of it, you know, that are pretty dubious and only sort of work by convincing, you become rich by convincing lots of other people that if they give you money, they'll become rich. And it sort of extends onwards, downwards in a shape alarmingly resembling a pyramid. Sincerity is difficult there. I mean, I think a lot of it is absolute nonsense, but that doesn't mean people don't believe it.
I am really not a fan of The Secret either. Like, I think, you know, again, it's why should anyone be entitled to tickets to a free trip to Mexico just because they believed that should appear in their mailbox? Like, that strikes me as ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is ridiculous. I think what it's often doing is taking some fairly out there New Age or, you know, somewhat Buddhist influenced ideas that I'm willing to talk about cosmic consciousness and the lack of boundaries between all of us. They're not very scientific, but I don't think they're necessarily flatly absurd. And then it's yoking them to this version of happiness that is so narrow and so shallow and is so... There's a problem with any approach to happiness or to therapy or lots of other things that just assumes that you know from the beginning what you want. Because my experience of being on this kind of journey is that the real process is in discovering what it is you really wanted and is actually in sort of reconsidering your goals and your philosophies of happiness instead of just finding the new method to get the thing that you already knew all along.
Well, it's interesting because you bring this up. You write a lot about writing, and you mentioned a quote from the novelist Rick Moody, who's talking about his writing routines. The quote he said was, "There's no one process. As soon as I imagine some approach to generating work as foolproof, it becomes suddenly worthless to me, and I have to start over."
I love that. I don't think it's just about writing processes either. I think it was a real revelation to me when I realized that, you know, whatever productivity technique I was using, whatever system I was using at the moment to organize my work or whatever sort of philosophy I was trying to have guide my my life or whatever approach I was going to take towards being a good partner in my relationship. What, you know, I didn't have to find the one that was going to last forever. And actually, it's pretty damaging and stressful if you do tell yourself you've got to find that. And they can sort of cycle in and out. And for 6 months, I will only be thinking about one approach. And then 6 months, it'll be another one. And that won't mean necessarily that the one I'm leaving behind was somehow worse or bad. It's just that, you know, I think the quest for the one perfect system is a certain kind of person, a certain kind of mindset to which I probably suffer, is very prone to that kind of, you know, I'm going to find the thing once and for all that makes everything else easy thereafter.
Well, and let me ask you this, because this is a problem I often have, and maybe you have it also. We both write, and when I hit publish on something, I'm usually a little bit scared. Like, will people like what I write? And I get disappointed in myself, and then I have to deal with it and figure out ways to deal with it. I get disappointed in myself if I think people don't like what I write. Now, I don't get disappointed in myself if it's controversial and people are upset or angry or whatever, but if just people ignore it. You know, ignoring you is the worst kind of way people could hate you. I feel a little bad and I have to deal with it. Like, how do you react to that?
I mean, I definitely agree with you that sort of getting a hostile reaction can often feel much better than getting no reaction at all. I guess one thing that's so good about the media and writing and landscape that we're in now is that there are all these opportunities for you can really see that it's a sort of long game that involves lots and lots of different installments. It's never too long after one that doesn't float anybody's boat. It's never too long until the next one is along. And I think, you know, in the days when there are big downsides to this, right? Like, you don't get time to write your damn books because you're too busy writing shorter things. But a big advantage of this environment is that you can get a sort of general sense of what's resonating and what's working, and things, you know, the day after nobody seems to read the blog post you've done, somebody will email you about a blog post you wrote a year ago with this most touching kind of words about the role it had in their life or something like that. So I think that is a really really great thing about it. This is not really advice, I suppose. It's just a sort of it's not really a method for dealing with it. It's just a sort of fact about the media ecology that we're
No, but it's true. And I wonder, like you say, there's always kind of the next one that you're going to write. And so then people will forget the other ones. Well, let's say you write like 10 posts in a row that are, you know, just something's going on in your life and you write 10 articles in a row that are just not good. And, you know, there's always this feeling, no matter what area of life you're in, you're only as good as your last X. And so you write a bunch of articles that you feel are like not up to your par. Do you feel like you could fall off the cliff a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I do. And I try to remind myself of very strange phenomena that I've noticed in my own writing, such as if I go back and look at something I wrote a year ago or more, I almost always think it's kind of pretty good. Like, you know, this guy was quite a good writer. The next thought that comes up is, that just shows I've got a lot worse in the intervening year. But I've now been doing this for much more than a year, so I know that that's not what's happening. What's happening is that when you are no longer aware of the, you know, the sausage being made, as they say, when you're not aware of the sort of chaos and randomness that goes into your writing work, because all you're seeing it from the outside, as it were, it just looks a lot more professional and it looks a lot more like together, because you're now in a sort of third person relationship to the author of that piece. So, you know, I think it's not some sort of watertight solution to the issue. I think as writers, we're always going to be neurotic and self questioning, but after a while you begin to see, oh yeah, no, I always think this now, and then I always don't think it again a bit later, or things get discovered later, or, you know, my book seems to be like it reached a lot of people quite a few months after any sort of marketing attempts to get it to people. So, you know, things like that are just like, you begin to see that like it all comes out okay in the end, I guess.
Well, you know, I guess also it reminds me of Seinfeld. Like, he does not want to get worse as a comedian, so he exercises that comedian muscle as much as he can. So no matter what happens, like his career, he doesn't worry about career because that's done. But he doesn't want to get worse as a comedian. He still checks the box every day. His famous chain.
Right, exactly. I asked him about that, by the way, and he said, like, it's so bizarre that anyone ever thought that was useful. It's just so dumb and stupid, he thought.
But he uses it.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, absolutely. He just can't believe that anyone would think it was valuable to hear about.
The other thing he said in his interview with you, which is related to something we just discussed a little earlier, in terms of, like, if you think of a process that's your perfect process, he said about relationships don't work, but comedians are in long marriages because they're smart. And so they know that in general, relationships don't work. So you might as well stay in the best relationship you can.
Right. Instead of having your life ruined by this perfectionistic fantasy that you never find, that against which you deem everything else that you experience to be insufficient. Yeah. Very wise, isn't he?
Yeah. That combined with the fact that he meditates then for 20 minutes a day or however long it is a day. He said to you he could talk to you for the whole interview about meditation, which I thought was interesting. Him and Howard Stern.
Yeah, he had to be drawn a little bit on the TM stuff, but it's basically, yeah, it's 20 minutes twice a day repeating a mantra to yourself, a secret mantra that I don't know his, and I don't think that if you did know his, it would make you into Jerry Seinfeld. But he said, you know, like once or twice every year you have a night's sleep that's really, really good and you wake up feeling totally refreshed, but you never do that the rest of the time because your life gets in the way. And I sort of empathize with that. And he's like, well, you know, meditation is like that kind of rest almost every time you do it, to him, he thought. So that's not quite my experience of meditation, but a very powerful way of talking about it.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not a believer that you should spend $1,500 to learn a meditation technique. But just in the past week, I've read about him, Howard Stern, Tim Ferriss, and Brian Koppelman, who's a screenwriter who's been on my podcast. All of them have talked about the benefits of meditation in their lives, and specifically TM, but I'll just make it more broadly meditation.
I will say, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I, you know, in the book, I went off and did a week's silent retreat in Massachusetts that was kind of pretty extraordinary to me. I will say this, I have done one, not TM, but I did do one meditation thing that did cost a proper amount of money, whereas most of them are sort of based on generosity and donations. And whatever you make of that, it's quite a good commitment mechanism, because once you've put down the money, you really don't want to be the sucker who gives up the very next day. And so it's quite a surprisingly good way of making yourself keep it going for a while. It didn't last indefinitely, but certainly a lot longer, because you'd sort of put the money down. So I don't know. I doubt that registers with Jerry Seinfeld, given what I assume to be his wealth. But it's sometimes that can work quite a clever way.
You know, you had one interesting article, and it's interesting because it's about being interesting. It's called How to Be Interesting and Why the Best Bits of Life Are More Than Interesting. You had an interesting description at the end by Eckhart Tolle, which is, you know, the sunset is this incredible miracle that happens every day, but no one's really that interested in it. We're always interested in, like, whatever is kind of the latest trending thing on Twitter, or, you know, the latest, you know, scientific theories that are extreme. What's your stance on interestingness?
Well, this came originally, I've got to give credit where it's due, from a paper published in the 70s called That's Interesting, a sociology paper by a guy called Murray Davis, which was surfaced by Adam Grant, who you, I'm sure, are aware of, the author of the book,
yes,
Give and Take.
He's been on the podcast.
Excellent. And he was using it, just to add to the number of names here, to explain some of the appeal of the books of Malcolm Gladwell. So there you go. The idea of this original paper is that, you know, the theories that have done really successfully in intellectual history, Freudianism or Marxism or certain probably libertarianism would count. Certainly, they don't succeed because they're true accounts of how humans work or how society works. They succeed because they're really interesting accounts of how society works. They make you see, or they make the suggestion that, you know, something that you thought was just at your time in history has actually been the same throughout history, or the other way around, something you thought was the same throughout history is actually only happening in your time, or that a collective phenomenon is individual, or an individual phenomenon is collective. They sort of, they give you a different lens on stuff, so that, you know, The Tipping Point is a great example of this, because it sort of says, okay, not all phenomena spread in a linear way. They sometimes spread like epidemics, so products and political ideas and social norms. They can spread in these kind of interesting ways. Anyway.
Well, but it's interesting. Two points about that. One is all of those that you mention are kind of self-helpish. So it's not like a biography of the football coach Vince Lombardi you would mention as interesting, even though that might be interesting to a certain group of people. All of those people you mentioned, and all of the people that, you know, Murray Davis mentions, like, you know, Marx and Freud and so on, they're all trying to make a model of the human condition that we can use to explain our lives and try to make our lives or our society better. So in that sense, they're interesting also.
Right. No, and actually this paper ends, it's very, it's almost as if you'd read it, because the paper that I'm talking about ends by saying the other thing it's got to have is something that changes people's life practices in some way. You know, it's no good being told that everything is other than how you thought it was if that has no effect on what you should do when you get up tomorrow. So that's also crucial for interestingness. And hey, there's nothing wrong with interestingness. It doesn't mean that a theory is wrong just because it's interesting. But
well,
I think what...
Sorry, you go ahead. Sorry, I keep interrupting.
I was just going to close up, come back round to the Eckhart Tolle point. You know, that I was trying to end by saying is that actually the things that are the most fulfilling and absorbing, whether that's time spent in nature or in a sort of deep relationship with other humans or spiritual practices, whatever they're going to be, they're not actually very interesting. I think Tolle says that, you know, like doing a PhD in the sunset, on the sunset, that might be interesting, but the sunset isn't interesting. And then actually you have to sort of go beyond something that your mind can sort of chew on. That's great and very entertaining and useful and whatever, but there's another level beyond that, which is where the mind sort of quietens down again and stops chewing, and you're just sort of present in the presence of a mystery, I guess.
There's so many interesting things I want to unpack from this, so I'll try to do it quickly. But the first is, you know, you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell and The Tipping Point, and that's a great example of a case where he describes this phenomenon that products, let's call them, you know, like Beanie Babies or whatever, well, suddenly they'll sell, and then suddenly have this tipping point where they'll sell millions. And he sort of shows example after example of products that hit a tipping point. But what I found about that book, as opposed to his book Outliers, what I found from The Tipping Point is he doesn't really give a method for getting to the tipping point. He just says that it exists. So I didn't really kind of find, I kind of wanted to find a method from it. And every CEO who bought the book sort of wanted a method. Yeah. But there was no method in there. As opposed to Outliers, he just plainly states, and it wasn't even his theory, but he plainly states, put in 10,000 hours of dedicated practice and you're going to be world class at what you do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he is pretty much single-handedly responsible for launching a genre of publishing. And The Tipping Point was its beginning. And a lot of it, I think, is based on people wanting practical advice, but not always being prepared to... Firstly, they want smart advice. They don't want sort of dumb self-help. And secondly, they may be a little bit embarrassed, actually, about just seeking out books that say, called How to Be a Success at Things. I think as that genre has grown and as Gladwell has written more of them himself, you know, it's starting to find its feet. And it's great. It's become a lot less weirdly embarrassing to be seen reading a book that tells you how to do things, you know. And so, which is helpful for me on two counts, because I sort of write that stuff and I kind of want to read it. So, but yeah, I think that's right. There isn't always a practical takeaway from those ideas.
Yeah. And, you know, the other interesting thing there is, you know, let's say the difference between all these people who are interesting and who are providing these models for the world and an Eckhart Tolle who talks about the sunset and just being calm in the sunset. Like, obviously we all realize the benefits in life that, oh, I wish I was just calm all the time. But at the same time, we're torn because we want to do things that are interesting in life. We want to be, you know, when you're young, you think to yourself, I want to be famous, or I want to be rich, or I want to write like the best-selling book of all time. You think to yourself, I'll be happy if I'm extremely interesting to everybody else. But at the same time, we sort of think, there's this huge benefit to being calm all the time. How do you kind of sort of combine these two differing, I would say, goals, say?
I don't think they are mutually exclusive, I mean, for most people. I think a lot of people, probably I'm one of them, there may be some people who I'm not, who can just like be born with such, you know, spiritual wisdom, but that they don't seek anything other than just, you know, pure presence and calm and contentment. I think for lots of people, you sort of have to try really hard to be special, to realize the joy of being ordinary, or that there are benefits to being ordinary. You have to sort of try to make these amazing projects work and often succeed, and they give a lot of pleasure, you know, but in order to see that beyond them, to the fact that, you know, I think ultimately that Tolle idea about just being there in the presence of the sunset is, you know, it is ultimately the thing to keep on your horizon. I don't think it means you're doing something wrong by trying to build stuff and make stuff and have a fascinating and interesting time. I just was reading a really interesting little book called The Art of Taking Action by a guy called Greg Krech. I don't know how it's pronounced, K-R-E-C-H, which is all about, like, he's an expert in various sort of Eastern spiritual approaches, but this is all about this idea of, like, we shouldn't just think about those traditions as being about passively sitting on a cushion watching your breath. Like, they are about how to take action as well. And actually adopting some of those mindsets are some of the most powerful ways, you know, and we've hinted at this in our conversation, I think, today, but, you know, to be calm in the face of the storm of emotions or whatever is actually a really great way to go and get stuff done, as well as it doesn't all have to be about sitting there with a beatific smile on your face and not desiring anything.
And so to get to that point, does he suggest, for instance, you know, like one Eastern approach to get to that point is to sit there and notice, you know, these negative emotions, but not try, but just notice them, not try to, like you said earlier, not try to suppress them or do away with them.
Right. I mean, he's actually a big practitioner of the Marita approach that we talked about earlier, you know, give up on yourself. So yeah, it's about once you can accommodate those emotions, once you're sort of okay when they're there, it's actually a kind of, you know, to be able to tolerate discomfort in that way is pretty much a superpower. I'm sure you agree with that. I mean,
yeah, no, I love this approach. Again, I'm going to totally steal it in a variety of ways. I mean, we've mentioned a bunch of very good books. You talked earlier about Albert Ellis. I've read his book, A Guide to Rational Living, which is really excellent. You know, Eckhart Tolle, of course, The Power of Now, the Merida books. Is there one book in particular?
I recommend this book. I mean, you can get Marita's original work, but I recommend this book, The Art of Taking Action by Greg Krech.
Okay, yeah. So The Art of Taking Action. There's your book, The Antidote. Let me get the subtitle up. The Antidote: Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. What other books did we talk about that were? Oh, Susan Jeffers' book,
Feel Fear and Do It Anyway. I think.
What books would you absolutely not recommend?
The Secret, The Power, whatever the most recent one is called. I think those Law of Attraction books can be safely put to one side. And, you know, I think those classics, Power of Positive Thinking, Think and Grow Rich, Win Friends and Influence People, their hearts are in the right place. Maybe it's useful, but I think they're fundamentally sort of not particularly well suited to where we find ourselves. Now, a book that I love that keeps coming up, a book about writing, is Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which I bet you've heard of, because it's a great sort of wise guide to writing, but not just writing, really.
Yes, you know, and it's funny, on my other podcast that I do with my wife, we had an argument because I like Bird by Bird, she doesn't, and we had this argument because a friend of ours, Tucker Max, who's written a bunch of best-selling books, he recommends all of these writing books, but he hates Bird by Bird. Because I guess the reality is her book is a little bit more philosophical and she hasn't written a best-selling book. So So there's the criticism there that she's not necessarily teaching about writing, but she's teaching about other ways of living.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I don't know what her bank account looks like. She seems to have a very successful life in many senses of the term. So, you know, I'm kind of open to philosophy from such people. There is always a problem, isn't there, if what you really want to do is be number one on the New York Times list. It's pretty hard to take advice on that from someone who hasn't, you know, spent plenty of time there themselves. Stephen King wrote a good book on writing.
Yes,
if that's what you want. Yeah.
That was Tucker's favorite. That's also my favorite writing book. But I actually like Bird by Bird quite a bit.
I also think that we need to slightly disconnect the idea of the giver of advice from the advice. You know, not just that someone doesn't need to be some huge commercial success to be a deliverer of good advice, but you know, apart from anything else, I think I am a channel for a lot of very good advice, but it doesn't mean I've successfully internalized it all and follow it perfectly in my own life. But that doesn't make it bad advice.
You know, it's true though. Like, do you ever get to a point where you're sort of feeling bad about something, and it's almost like you've been feeling bad all day, and it's almost to the point where it's reaching like an obsession. And then you say, you know, I write all day long about self-help and advice and whatever, and here I can't even follow my own advice. Does that help you bring you back to following your advice?
Often it does. You know, when I suddenly realize that the answer to what I'm going through is something I wrote in my book a couple of years ago, like, that's kind of humbling. What I really think, more seriously, I guess, is we're now in a very nice part time, I think, a very good time in the culture when it comes to advice, which is lots and lots of people feel free to pass on what lessons they've learned. People feel uninhibited about discussing things that might work. I think people have a very realistic idea about who's delivering that advice. So I'm not keen on gurus who set themselves up as sort of flawless exemplars of things. I think the idea that advice is like a conversation among equals, and that we've got things to learn from each other, and then we have to go back and learn the thing that we were giving out as advice 6 months ago, I think that's a good situation. I think it's a very sort of, you know, all of us doing life philosophy together. I think it's great. I wouldn't want to return to a situation where you had a few people pretending to be perfect and the rest of us all kneeling at their feet.
Well, it's interesting because 2 points about that. One is Buddha, you know, who I think is, you know, not only was a very good self-help guy for his time.
He was a pretty good guy all around, yeah.
Yeah, he even says, look, don't believe me. This works for me, but why don't you go out and try this for yourself and see if it works for you? So, which is a great marketing technique.
Yeah, absolutely. And nice, you know, I think it's much better that way, much healthier situation.
You know, the other thing I want to point out is that there are so many kind of like, there's all these sites that aggregate these kind of self-help sort of blogs in business or health or whatever, and the author is invisible. So he might say, you know, 5 techniques to rise up the corporate ladder, but you never see how the author dealt with the hardships of rising up the corporate ladder. So I agree with you. You need to kind of put yourself in the story if you're going to.
Well, and that's why I love so much of your stuff, because you've taken this to a sort of. I hope I'm not going to insult you here. I hope I'm going to compliment you as intended. But like, you know, you've taken this to a high level. Nobody could read your work and think that what your life had been was a perfect, unbroken ascent up a perfect trend line of, you know,
right,
getting better and better and better. And it's amazing how many people would have you believe that about their lives. Or maybe they had one crisis where they hit rock bottom, and then after that they became a self-help guru and everything was perfect. But the sort of multiple bottom hittings, as it were, that you've written about, I think that's just like, you know, I'd far rather take advice from someone who was going to tell me about that than someone who was going to claim otherwise.
Right. Although then you go to the extreme, like, you know, you mentioned in the antidote, you visited Eckhart Tolle at his home in Vancouver. And I really like his book, The Power of Now. And you really couldn't break him down at all. Like, he seemed like the real deal to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think he is what he says he is. And which is not, by the way, that's the other thing about The Power of Now. Like, if you really read that book looking for the pseudoscience and the nonsense, there are two or three pages where I wish he hadn't used certain phrases, and he talks about cosmic vibrations or women being more in touch with enlightenment than men. And you're just like, well, what's your basis for these? And it's a little bit dubious. But the vast majority of it is not pseudoscience, because it is not pretending to be science. It is just saying, look inside, again, you know, see if this resonates for you. And if this way of thinking about your inner life, you know, you might find it really powerful. And so I think people sometimes mischaracterize the claims that people like him are making. They're not, he's not claiming that if you think really hard about a Lamborghini, you'll get one. You know, that it's not that kind of stuff at all. It's just a sort of exercise in introspection. Yeah, that can be really helpful.
Well, Oliver, this has been really enlightening. You've given me not only a whole bunch of books to read, but an entire list of books to steal from. So I thank you for that. And I do have to say, I've really enjoyed your book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. I really thought, when I first picked it up, I thought it was just going to be trashing self-help, but it really was like a good sort of coverage of the entire spectrum of self-help, and your, not only what you think, but your exploration into it, which again, I like it when, you know, it's this Gladwellian approach where you put yourself into the story.
I'm glad you saw that. I really didn't want it to just be destructive. You know, I wanted to take down some things, but then I wanted to offer something constructive in their place. Yeah.
No, it's really a worthwhile book to read for anybody who really is interested in the topic of bettering their life, which hopefully we all are. I think many of the listeners to this podcast are. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and it gave me a lot of food for thought.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was an excellent, very enjoyable conversation. I really enjoyed it too.
Thanks, Oliver. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
For more from James, check out The James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.